Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Consider the lowly earthworm. A friend to gardeners, it's death to forests. The invasion of non-native species like earthworms is just one of the consequences of human development and its encroachment on forest ecosystems. Another challenge is climate change. Ecologists specializing in integrated landscape management recently got together to discuss how these impacts will influence future land use planning for Alberta's boreal forest. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The pressures on Alberta's forests from human activity is overwhelming. There's logging and energy development. There's encroachment from agriculture. And as more people move into the north, there's the addition of roads, utility corridors, and urban sprawl. Not only are we losing forest, the change in habitat is seriously affecting the animals that call the forest their home. So much so that species from further south are starting to move into the boreal forest. Dr. Stan Booten holds an NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management at the University of Alberta. He's researching the impact of human activities on the forest landscape and what industry can do to significantly reduce its footprint. Stan recently hosted a workshop for his fellow researchers and industrial partners.
Well, we work on two aspects in ILM. One is to develop models and use models that allow us to realistically look at what the future may hold depending on different policy frameworks, different levels of human activity on the land base, how those different levels spin off onto ecological issues. Because what we're our main interest is in trying to develop ecologically informed land use decisions. And to do that, you have to think on large scales and over long time frames, and that requires the use of models. So that's one main aspect. But to make those models work, you also have to be able to make sure you can link things you do, actions of people, to various indicators of importance, ecological, economic, and social indicators. And any time you have an uncertainty in doing that, that's a right place to do research. So we focus in on what we call key uncertainties, where we can't currently link our actions to our indicators because there's some unknown science involved. And one of those main uncertainties we're focusing on right now is currently with our changing land use activities and probably changing climate, there are a number of species that are invading our northern forests, our boreal forests, and those invasions of species that normally don't live there, we think have very widespread implications to other parts of the system.
What might some of those invading species be?
Well, I think people would be surprised at what they might be. The main ones we're focusing on are three, actually. Two people know a lot about, and that's white-tailed deer and coyotes. And they're very common in southern parts of the province, but in fact they have not been major players in the boreal forest until recent times, but now they're becoming very prominent, and they have real big spin-off implications to another important player in the system, and that's woodland caribou. And as deer numbers go up, wolves respond by going up, and then the increase in wolves seems to have very major negative effects on caribou. The third species that no one ever thinks about is earthworms, of all things. And there are many species involved, but all earthworms in Alberta are, in fact, introduced. We lost all of our earthworm population with the last glaciation, and we've now reintroduced them, or appear to be reintroducing them, through fishing and the release of worms after people are done fishing. And everyone thinks earthworms are good, but in fact, for some forested regions, they actually have lots of negative effects, and we're, in fact, studying to see whether that's true in our boreal forests.
With the integrated landscape management work that you and your students have been doing, a lot of it is focused on forestry and energy, but I also noticed through the talks today that there's an increasing emphasis on agriculture. What part does agriculture play in this?
We are not sure, but it has to be considered very carefully in that as we see a movement northward of a lot of changes in our system, that movement in terms of human activity usually has three fronts. It's an agricultural front, a forestry front and to some extent an energy front. And certainly in Canada and in Alberta in particular, that transition from the south to the north is reflected in all of those aspects. But agriculture is one activity, just as it was when the prairies were first converted to agriculture, which is a long-term major effect in terms of the vegetation and the habitats that it creates. So we have to be always very aware of it. It's never going to be as big in the north as it has been in southern parts of the province, but that doesn't mean that it can't have big potential effects on other parts of the system. And that's why we're now starting to incorporate it over and above the energy sector and the forestry sector that are more traditional human land uses in our northern areas.
How is this research going to be applied? Who's involved in the application, the integration?
We try and engage a number of partners right at the start in terms of when we do the research to hope that it will get implemented into their activities. ILM grew as an initial industry-to-industry interaction where industries sat down with each other to try and look at ways that they could reduce the size, duration, and intensity of their collective footprint. And that got us started. And it led to industries doing co-planning activities to achieve these ends. But we've now moved to the much more challenging aspect, which is thinking about land use planning on a very broad perspective, and by broad I'm meaning all of Alberta. And we feel that if we're going to try and maintain some of our ecological values someplace in Alberta, we're going to have to do that by judicious land use planning. And in the end, I think that means we're going to use or move to what I call priority land use zoning, where we treat the greater Alberta in a very similar way to what we do with cities, where we zone cities for commercial areas, rural residential, etc. types of areas, and you know when you're in that part of the city, you're allowed certain activities and others are just not acceptable. Until we start to consider that sort of aspect in Alberta on the greater land base, we probably are not going to be able to achieve many of the things we want. And in fact, we'll have a very watered down version everywhere, every place, all of the time. And I just don't think that we want that type of land management system, which is my view of what the current system is.
Thank you very much, Stan.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Stan Booten. He holds an NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management at the University of Alberta. One of the non-native species that's invading Alberta's northern forest is the lowly earthworm. While earthworms do a great job of composting material for your garden, that's the very last thing you want to happen in the boreal forest. Aaron Cameron is a master's student associated with the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta, and she's researching the impact of the earthworm invasion.
Earthworms can act as ecosystem engineers, and basically, they can decrease the leaf litter layer and cause mixing of soil. And then that has effects on plants and animal communities as well. I've mostly been looking at how earthworms spread in northern Alberta.
Are earthworms normal or natural around here?
No, they're actually introduced from Europe. All of the species I've found are European. In the States, there's also some Asian species being introduced. It's believed that the native earthworms were extirpated during the last glaciation about 10,000 years ago.
What has been the movement of earthworms then?
We think that they were introduced via the first settlers and then that they've spread sort of across the country since then. In Alberta, there were there are several forests near Kananaskis that they invaded in the mid-1980s. In the boreal forest, we're not as sure when introductions may have begun.
So is there an actual concern over earthworms getting into the forest? I know for myself as a gardener, I think earthworms are good.
Yeah, I'd say definitely with some of the results that have come out of the United States and southern Alberta, there's a definite concern for their effects. possibly in terms of forest production and even birds and small mammals and plant diversity.
What do they actually do then in the forest?
They basically decrease the thickness of the leaf litter by consuming the litter, and then they can mix the organic and mineral soil layers. And the leaf litter layer is necessary for a lot of plants because their seeds germinate in that layer. And then through that disruption of the soil, they can also affect nutrient cycling and things like that. And then there's sort of effects from that on plants and animals.
Are there other places other than Alberta then where the invasion of earthworms has been a concern?
The major research has been done in Minnesota in the United States, and they're seeing forests that are basically transformed, I guess, after earthworm invasions. So they've had public awareness campaigns and laws to ban abandonment of bait there.
Well, when you say the forest has been transformed, what sort of transformation? Can you give me an example?
Basically, instead of seeing leaf litter across the floor of the forest, you see bare ground. And instead of seeing like a cover of small forb species, you see grass often instead. There's also less undercover shrubs and understory plants as well. These were sugar maple forests, however, so it's not as clear what forests would look like in Alberta after invasion.
How have you been doing your research? What sorts of things have you been looking at?
I've been looking at whether bait abandonment or transport by vehicles or more natural spread along waterways or by vertebrates such as robins are important in earthworm spread. So I've gone to lots of lakes in northern Alberta and sampled by boat launches and roads and areas farther from human activities. And then I've used that data to determine if earthworms occur mainly near boat launches and roads. And in fact, they did, which would suggest that bait abandonment and vehicle transport are very important.
So these are the types of worms, then, that anglers would use to catch fish?
Yeah, a number of the species are ones that anglers would use to catch fish. There's also a couple of smaller species that wouldn't normally be used as bait.
How quickly do they spread, then, once they get into an area, if you... you know, look in the soil, how many would you find?
There can be numbers as high as a couple hundred per meter squared. Depends on the species. And then the conventional wisdom is that they spread about 2 to 4 meters per year. But some of my data would suggest that it's more like 10 meters per year. And some other researchers have found numbers like that as well.
So what conclusions have you come to then?
Mainly that bait abandonment and vehicle transport are important in spread, and also that older roads tend to be invaded more often than younger roads, which suggests that traffic is very important rather than road construction. And I'm also doing some genetic research, which has kind of backed up some of those findings.
Well, when you say vehicles, do they attach themselves to the vehicles? Or what? I would think they'd get squished.
yes, it's mostly, or it's likely that the cocoons of the earthworms are what are being transported on the vehicles. Cocoons are basically like small eggs, and they contain several embryos. So they can become trapped in tire treads and then spread that way. It's possible that earthworms are being moved along as well, but the main thing that's spreading is probably the cocoons.
What's next for you in terms of this research?
This summer I'm going to be looking at the effects of earthworm spread on the distribution of robins, and I'll also be starting to look at some effects of earthworms on leaf litter decomposition.
Well, thank you very much, Aaron.
Thanks.
That was Aaron Cameron, a master's student with the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. Dr. Stan Booten's Integrated Landscape Management Program has researched many areas where people and industries can lessen their impact on the forest ecosystem. But one topic that's only now coming into focus is a wild card, and that's climate change. Dr. Rick Schneider is a conservation biologist who is now taking on the climate change challenge. At the recent workshop on integrated landscape management, he outlined how different climate change models might be incorporated into future land use planning.
Till now, I guess we've had a head-in-the-sand attitude about global warming as we've done land use planning, meaning that we just pretend that it isn't going to happen. And I mean, there were good reasons for that, since up to a few years ago, the models for predicting climate change were not that reliable. But I think given the amount of attention that's been directed toward climate change over the last number of years, last decade anyway, the climate models around the world, various research institutes producing and using these climate models are producing predictions that are starting to coalesce. In other words, they're not all over the map. We're seeing some pretty clear trends. And so the reliability of the models is such that, it's time to take heed of what their findings are.
Well, let's look at predictions. What are some likely scenarios for climate change? What would they do to the forest? What can we expect from past experience?
Well, what the climate models are showing is here in Alberta, we can expect probably on the order of a 3 degrees centigrade rise in temperature over the next 50 to 100 years. So where there is uncertainty still is in the length of time that it's going to take. There seems to be a fairly clear trend towards a rising of, let's say, approximately 3 degrees, might be a little more, might be a little less. But it's not as clear as to when that will happen. Will it be as quick as 50 years or will it take 100? That kind of thing is a little bit less clear. So just to put that into more understandable terms, it means that places like Fort McMurray or Grand Prairie will have the climate of Medicine Hat or Lethbridge in about 80 years from now. The other important thing is that there's going to be a change in precipitation, but not as marked. Most of the models are showing about a 15% increase in precipitation, and that might seem positive, and indeed global warming isn't clearly negative or positive in any area. There are always pluses and minuses. But in Alberta, this interaction between warming and only a slight increase in precipitation actually has pretty large implications. And for any listeners that have been tuned into what's happening in Australia recently, I just was listening to the story on the way in on CBC this morning. It's exactly the same scenario. They've had a rise in precipitation, but and this is already happening. This is not the future. This is what's already happened over the last 10 to 20 years in Australia. They've had a rise in temperature, but only a slight rise in precipitation, and the heating that the extra temperature brings, the heating of the soil and so on, it dries up the ground, it dries up the rivers, and there's a lot more variability that comes along with climate change as well.
Now, you discussed three different models that you would be looking at, and one of them had to do with what happened several thousand years ago. Could you tell me a bit about that one?
Sure. If we're going to incorporate climate change into land use planning, which is the ultimate aim of the ILM group and the projects that we've got running, you need to make a linkage between the changes in actual climate and what's happening on the ground, particularly in terms of vegetation. And so the real challenge before us comes in trying to predict how our forests and grasslands and so on are going to react to these changes in temperature and precipitation. And there are three ways to look at that, and one of the ways is to look back in time. So as you mentioned yesterday, I spoke about the paleoecology work that has been done here in Alberta, basically looking at pollen back in ancient soil layers. And if you look back about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, one finds that there was a period of warming, about a 2,000-year period of warming, and it was roughly the same amount that we're projecting for the future here, roughly 2 to 3 degrees warmer at that time. And what happened was that the grasslands that we find in southern Alberta, they moved northward and basically took over the entire parkland region, and much of the boreal forest, or what is boreal today, was all covered in grassland. And then the parkland, you know, what people are familiar with around Edmonton, the aspen groves and open spaces in between them, that was just rings of parkland around some of the higher areas like the Caribou Mountains and Birch Mountains and so on, and only little islands of remnants of boreal forest left. So that is a sort of an analogy, I guess, a picture of, you know, what we can probably expect over time as our climate again warms to the same degree.
What other models are you looking at?
Well, we had a look at something called a dynamic vegetation model. These are pretty well new models where people are trying to, if you will, grow a forest artificially in a computer by including basic mechanisms of growth and competition for light and water and basic relationships to climate. So plants have their individual tolerances to temperature and water needs and so on. So if you know enough about those basic mechanisms, you could predict how a forest will grow and how it will change as temperature changes. But those models are still too new to actually be used reliably today. So that's a sort of a work in progress. So we have put that off to the back burner for now. And instead, we focused on another class of models that uses statistical relationships between climate and vegetation. And the basic principle there is that if you know the climate, you can actually remarkably well, you can predict what the vegetation is going to be at a coarse scale. I mean, not at a small stand level. No, you're not going to be able to say anything of meaning. But when you look at a province level, it works remarkably well. You look at climate, you look at things like temperature, precipitation, you have a fairly good idea of what kind of forest or grassland or whatever you're going to find there. So using those kind of statistical relationships, if you can quantify them. I mean, that's the key trick, is to quantify those relationships between climate variables and between vegetation. Then you can predict what will be found in the future under a different climate. And we're looking at a couple of different approaches to using in our work, which is going to look at more on the impacts. So our key questions are, you know, if the grassland does again move north and the parkland moves north and the boreal becomes small remnants, what does that mean for a whole variety of land use questions that are being asked today? As an example, you know, caribou planning or any kind of endangered species research, a key question is habitat. And if that habitat is going to change dramatically, well, one would want to know that before you go too far down any particular path. The key deficiency that's facing us is the rate of change. So these statistical relationships I mentioned earlier give us a pretty clear indication of you know, what the future landscape is going to look like, but they don't tell us how long it's going to take to get there. The mature trees that are on the site right now are actually quite resistant to climate change. It's only after disturbance takes the mature individuals out that you see a problem with regeneration. That's where most of the change actually happens. A big fire takes out a mature forest, and the seedlings coming back, for example, in a much drier condition, will fail to regenerate properly. And, you know, you get then this gradual, it doesn't happen overnight, but gradual over many decades, a slow transition to more and more open landscape, which we can expect to see.
How do you integrate the modeling for climate with the modeling that's being done to try and figure out what impact industrial practices have on habitat and the boreal ecosystems?
Well, that's a key focus of our work. So there's kind of two main themes. One is to just get a climate model up and running for Alberta's. So there's a lot of work being done nationally and internationally, but at a very, very coarse scale. Nobody's really taken it yet down to the provincial and regional scale and say, you know, how are those biomes going to change and when will it occur? So those are just key basic questions that we want to answer first and take the model out for a run. Make sure it works, you know, according to how we expect it to work. There's a lot of basic technical steps needed to get the model up and running. But then the idea is once we have the model and it's in a form, we're going to be using ELSI's that is applicable to many other questions. So ALSI's is be most likely the model we're going to work with. It's already set up for asking, as you mentioned, a bunch of other land use questions. So in other words, when you are asking a question about, let's say, linear disturbance or something like that, or with respect to, use caribou as an example, you'll have the option of turning on or off a climate lever.
Is there any harmonization between these different models, so that you know the data or the statistics or the predictions that you get are reliable across the models?
What's happening is that you have a number of climate centers now around the globe, actually. There's a good dozen of them at least. And they're, in a sense, almost competing with each other. And it's purposefully done that. So you're not kind of having one global model that does everything for everyone, because we want to be sure that we're testing, or at least trying to cover as many of the bases as we can. So different people have different ideas about some of the details about how things work. So the International Panel on Climate Change is taking on a coordinating role, if you will. The research groups do their own work, but the IPCC has put forward a set of 40 scenarios. They didn't just make these up themselves. Again, it was a collective effort to say, well, of the various ways that the planet may move forward in terms of, you know, how good we are at reducing CO2 or how bad we are, there's a whole variety of ways that life could proceed. They've boiled those down into 40, which are grouped into subsets. And now the teams that are actually running the climate scenarios, they tend to focus on those 40 scenarios, all of them running the same kinds of questions with the same assumptions about how life will proceed. So that now you can look at the output, which are also standardized to a certain degree, and they are also shared.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Rick Schneider, a conservation biologist and a research associate in the Integrated Landscape Management Program at the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management, Genome Alberta, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.